Book 1, Chapter 1. Selden paused in surprise. In the afternoon rush of the Grand Central Station, his eyes had been refreshed by the sight of Miss Lily Bart. It was a Monday in early September, and he was returning to his work from a hurried dip into the country, but what was Miss Bart doing in town at that season? If she had appeared to be catching a train, he might have inferred that he had come on her in the act of transition between one and another of the country houses which disputed her presence after the close of the Newport season. But her desultory air perplexed him. She stood apart from the crowd, letting it drift by her to the platform or the street, and wearing an air of irresolution which might, as he surmised, be the mask of a very definite purpose. It struck him at once that she was waiting for someone, but he hardly knew why the idea arrested him. There was nothing new about Lily Bart, yet he could never see her without a faint movement of interest. It was characteristic of her that she always roused speculation, that her simplest acts seemed the result of far-reaching intentions. An impulse of curiosity made him turn out of his direct line to the door, and stroll past her. He knew that if she did not wish to be seen she would contrive to elude him, and it amused him to think of putting her skill to the test. "Mr. Selden, what good luck!" She came forward smiling, eager almost, in her resolve to intercept him. One or two persons, in brushing past them, lingered to look, for Miss Bart was a figure to arrest even the suburban traveler rushing to his last train. Selden had never seen her more radiant. Her vivid head, relieved against the dull tints of the crowd, made her more conspicuous than in a ballroom, and under her dark hat and veil she regained the girlish smoothness, the purity of tint, that she was beginning to lose after 11 years of late hours and indefatigable dancing. Was it really 11 years, Selden found himself wondering, and had she indeed reached the 29th birthday with which her rivals credited her? "What luck!" she repeated. "How nice of you to come to my rescue!" He responded joyfully that to do so was his mission in life, and asked what form the rescue was to take. "Oh, almost any, even to sitting on a bench and talking to me. One sits out a cotillion, why not sit out a train? It isn't a bit hotter here than in Mrs. Van Osburgh's conservatory, and some of the women are not a bit uglier." She broke off, laughing, to explain that she had come up to town from Tuxedo, on her way to the Gustrenners at Bellamont, and had missed the 3:15 train to Rhinebeck. "And there isn't another till 5:30. She consulted the little jeweled watch among her laces. "Just 2 hours to wait. And I don't know what to do with myself. My maid came up this morning to do some shopping for me, and was to go on to Bellamont at 1 o'clock, and my aunt's house is closed, and I don't know a soul in town." She glanced plaintively about the station. "It is hotter than Mrs. Van Osburgh's, after all. If you can spare the time, do take me somewhere for a breath of air." He declared himself entirely at her disposal. The adventure struck him as diverting. As a spectator, he had always enjoyed Lily Bart, and his course lay so far out of her orbit that it amused him to be drawn for a moment into the sudden intimacy which her proposal implied. "Shall we go over to Sherry's for a cup of tea?" She smiled assentingly, and then made a slight grimace. "So many people come up to town on a Monday, one is sure to meet a lot of bores. I'm as old as the hills, of course, and it ought not to make any difference, but if I'm old enough, you're not," she objected gaily. "I'm dying for tea, but isn't there a quieter place?" He answered her smile, which rested on him vividly. Her discretions interested him almost as much as her imprudences, he was so sure that both were part of the same carefully elaborated plan. In judging Miss Bart, he had always made use of the argument from design. "The resources of New York are rather meager," he said, "but I'll find a hansom first, and then we'll invent something." He led her through the throng of returning holidaymakers, past sallow-faced girls in preposterous hats, and flat-chested women struggling with paper bundles and palm-leaf fans. Was it possible that she belonged to the same race? The dinginess, the crudity of this average section of womanhood made him feel how highly specialized she was. A rapid shower had cooled the air, and clouds still hung refreshingly over the moist street. "How delicious! Let us walk a little," she said as they emerged from the station. They turned into Madison Avenue and began to stroll northward. As she moved beside him, with her long light step, Selden was conscious of taking a luxurious pleasure in her nearness, in the modeling of her little ear, the crisp upward wave of her hair, was it ever so slightly brightened by art? And the thick planting of her straight black lashes. Everything about her was at once vigorous and exquisite, at once strong and fine. He had a confused sense that she must have cost a great deal to make, that a great many dull and ugly people must, in some mysterious way, have been sacrificed to produce her. He was aware that the qualities distinguishing her from the herd of her sex were chiefly external, as though a fine glaze of beauty and fastidiousness had been applied to vulgar clay. Yet the analogy left him unsatisfied, for a coarse texture will not take a high finish, and was it not possible that the material was fine, but that circumstance had fashioned it into a futile shape? As he reached this point in his speculations, the sun came out, and her lifted parasol cut off his enjoyment. A moment or two later she paused with a sigh. "Oh, dear, I'm so hot and thirsty, and what a hideous place New York is." She looked despairingly up and down the dreary thoroughfare. Other cities put on their best clothes in summer, but New York seems to sit in its shirt sleeves. Her eyes wandered down one of the side streets. "Someone has had the humanity to plant a few trees over there. Let us go into the shade." "I am glad my street meets with your approval," said Selden as they turned the corner. "Your street? Do you live here?" She glanced with interest along the new brick and limestone house fronts, fantastically varied in obedience to the American craving for novelty, but fresh and inviting with their awnings and flower boxes. "Ah, yes, to be sure, the Benedict. What a nice-looking building. I don't think I've ever seen it before." She looked across at the flat house with its marble porch and pseudo-Georgian facade. "Which are your windows? Those with the awnings down?" "On the top floor, yes." "And that nice little balcony is yours? How cool it looks up there." He paused a moment. "Come up and see," he suggested. "I can give you a cup of tea in no time and you won't meet any bores." Her color deepened. She still had the art of blushing at the right time, but she took the suggestion as lightly as it was made. "Why not? It's too tempting. I'll take the risk," she declared. "Oh, I'm not dangerous," he said in the same key. In truth, he had never liked her as well as at that moment. He knew she had accepted without afterthought. He could never be a factor in her calculations, and there was a surprise, a refreshment almost, in the spontaneity of her consent. On the threshold he paused a moment, feeling for his latchkey. "There's no one here, but I have a servant who is supposed to come in the mornings, and it's just possible he may have put out the tea things and provided some cake." He ushered her into a slip of a hall hung with old prints. She noticed the letters and notes heaped on the table among his gloves and sticks. Then she found herself in a small library, dark but cheerful, with its walls of books, a pleasantly faded Turkey rug, a littered desk and, as he had foretold, a tea tray on a low table near the window. A breeze had sprung up, swaying inward the muslin curtains, and bringing a fresh scent of mignonette and petunias from the flower box on the balcony. Lily sank with a sigh into one of the shabby leather chairs. How delicious to have a place like this all to oneself. What a miserable thing it is to be a woman. She leaned back in a luxury of discontent. Selden was rummaging in a cupboard for the cake. "Even women," he said, "have been known to enjoy the privileges of a flat. Oh, governesses or widows. But not girls, not poor, miserable, marriageable girls. I even know a girl who lives in a flat." She sat up in surprise. "You do?" "I do," he assured her, emerging from the cupboard with the sought for cake. "Oh, I know you mean Gertie Farish." She smiled a little unkindly. "But I said marriageable, and besides, she has a horrid little place, and no maid, and such queer things to eat. Her cook does the washing and the food tastes of soap. I should hate that, you know." "You shouldn't dine with her on wash days," said Selden, cutting the cake. They both laughed, and he knelt by the table to light the lamp under the kettle, while she measured out the tea into a little teapot of green glaze. As he watched her hand, polished as a bit of old ivory, with its slender pink nails, and the sapphire bracelet slipping over her wrist, he was struck with the irony of suggesting to her such a life as his cousin Gertrude Farish had chosen. She was so evidently the victim of a civilization which had produced her, that the links of her bracelet seemed like manacles chaining her to her fate. She seemed to read his thought. "It was horrid of me to say that of Gertie," she said with charming compunction. "I forgot she was your cousin. But we're so different, you know. She likes being good, and I like being happy. And besides, she is free and I am not. If I were, I dare say I could manage to be happy even in her flat. It must be pure bliss to arrange the furniture just as one likes, and give all the horrors to the ash man. If I could only do over my aunt's drawing room, I know I should be a better woman." "Is it so very bad?" he asked sympathetically. She smiled at him across the teapot which she was holding up to be filled. "That shows how seldom you come there. Why don't you come oftener?" "When I do come, it's not to look at Mrs. Peniston's furniture." "Nonsense," she said. "You don't come at all, and yet we get on so well when we meet." "Perhaps that's the reason," he answered promptly. "I'm afraid I haven't any cream, you know. Shall you mind a slice of lemon instead?" "I shall like it better." She waited while he cut the lemon and dropped a thin disc into her cup. "But that is not the reason," she insisted. The reason for what? For your never coming. She leaned forward with a shade of perplexity in her charming eyes. I wish I could make you out. Of course I know there are men who don't like me and can tell that at a glance. And there are others who are afraid of me, they think I wanted to marry them. She smiled up at him frankly. But I don't think you dislike me and you can't possibly think I want to marry you. No, I absolve you of that, he agreed. Well, then? He had carried his cup to the fireplace, and stood leaning against the chimneypiece and looking down on her with an air of indolent amusement. The provocation in her eyes increased his amusement. He had not supposed she would waste her powder on such small game, but perhaps she was only keeping her hand in, or perhaps a girl of her type had no conversation but of the personal kind. At any rate, she was amazingly pretty, and he had asked her to tea and must live up to his obligations. Well, then, he said with a plunge, perhaps that's the reason. What? The fact that you don't want to marry me. Perhaps I don't regard it as such a strong inducement to go and see you. He felt a slight shiver down his spine as he ventured this, but her laugh reassured him. Dear Mr. Selden, that wasn't worthy of you. It's stupid of you to make love to me, and it isn't like you to be stupid. She leaned back, sipping her tea with an air so enchantingly judicial that, if they had been in her aunt's drawing room, he might almost have tried to disprove her deduction. Don't you see, she continued, that there are men enough to say pleasant things to me, and that what I want is a friend who won't be afraid to say disagreeable ones when I need them? Sometimes I have fancied you might be that friend. I don't know why, except that you are neither a prig nor a bounder, and that I shouldn't have to pretend with you or be on my guard against you. Her voice had dropped to a note of seriousness, and she sat gazing up at him with the troubled gravity of a child. You don't know how much I need such a friend, she said. My aunt is full of copybook axioms, but they were all meant to apply to conduct in the early 50s. I always feel that to live up to them would include wearing book muslin with jigget sleeves. And the other women my best friends, well, they use me or abuse me, but they don't care a straw what happens to me. I've been about too long. People are getting tired of me, they are beginning to say I ought to marry. There was a moment's pause, during which Selden meditated one or two replies calculated to add a momentary zest to the situation, but he rejected them in favor of the simple question, well, why don't you? She colored and laughed. Ah, I see you're a friend after all, and that is one of the disagreeable things I was asking for. It wasn't meant to be disagreeable, he returned amicably. Isn't marriage your vocation? Isn't it what you're all brought up for? She sighed. I suppose so. What else is there? Exactly. And so why not take the plunge and have it over? She shrugged her shoulders. You speak as if I ought to marry the first man who came along. I didn't mean to imply that you are as hard put to it as that. But there must be someone with the requisite qualifications. She shook her head wearily. I threw away one or two good chances when I first came out. I suppose every girl does, and you know I am horribly poor and very expensive. I must have a great deal of money. Selden had turned to reach for a cigarette box on the mantelpiece. What's become of Dilworth? He asked. Oh, his mother was frightened. She was afraid I should have all the family jewels reset. And she wanted me to promise that I wouldn't do over the drawing room. The very thing you were marrying for. Exactly. So she packed him off to India. Hard luck, but you can do better than Dilworth. He offered the box, and she took out three or four cigarettes, putting one between her lips and slipping the others into a little gold case attached to her long pearl chain. Have I time? Just a whiff, then. She leaned forward, holding the tip of her cigarette to his. As she did so, he noted, with a purely impersonal enjoyment, how evenly the black lashes were set in her smooth white lids, and how the purplish shade beneath them melted into the pure pallor of the cheek. She began to saunter about the room, examining the bookshelves between the puffs of her cigarette smoke. Some of the volumes had the ripe tints of good tooling and old Morocco, and her eyes lingered on them caressingly, not with the appreciation of the expert, but with the pleasure in agreeable tones and textures that was one of her inmost susceptibilities. Suddenly her expression changed from desultory enjoyment to active conjecture, and she turned to Selden with a question. You collect, don't you know about first editions and things? As much as a man may who has no money to spend. Now and then I pick up something in the rubbish heap, and I go and look on at the big sales. She had again addressed herself to the shelves, but her eyes now swept them inattentively, and he saw that she was preoccupied with a new idea. And Americana, do you collect Americana? Selden stared and laughed. No, that's rather out of my line. I'm not really a collector, you see, I simply like to have good editions of the books I am fond of. She made a slight grimace. And Americana are horribly dull, I suppose? I should fancy so, except to the historian. But your real collector values a thing for its rarity. I don't suppose the buyers of Americana sit up reading them all night. Old Jefferson Grice certainly didn't. She was listening with keen attention. And yet they fetch fabulous prices, don't they? It seems so odd to want to pay a lot for an ugly, badly printed book that one is never going to read. And I suppose most of the owners of Americana are not historians either? No, very few of the historians can afford to buy them. They have to use those in the public libraries or in private collections. It seems to be the mere rarity that attracts the average collector. He had seated himself on an arm of a chair near which she was standing, and she continued to question him, asking which were the rarest volumes, whether the Jefferson Grice collection was really considered the finest in the world, and what was the largest price ever fetched by a single volume. It was so pleasant to sit there looking up at her, as she lifted now one book and then another from the shelves, fluttering the pages between her fingers, while her drooping profile was outlined against the warm background of old bindings, that he talked on without pausing to wonder at her sudden interest in so unsuggestive a subject. But he could never be along with her without trying to find a reason for what she was doing, and as she replaced his first edition of La Bruyère and turned away from the bookcases, he began to ask himself what she had been driving at. Her next question was not of a nature to enlighten him. She paused before him with a smile which seemed at once designed to admit him to her familiarity, and to remind him of the restrictions it imposed. "Don't you ever mind," she asked suddenly, "not being rich enough to buy all the books you want?" He followed her glance about the room, with its worn furniture and shabby walls. "Don't I just? Do you take me for a saint on a pillar? And having to work, do you mind that?" "Oh, the work itself is not so bad. I'm rather fond of the law." "No, but the being tied down, the routine. Don't you ever want to get away, to see new places and people?" "Horribly, especially when I see all my friends rushing to the steamer." She drew a sympathetic breath. "But do you mind enough to marry to get out of it?" Selden broke into a laugh. "God forbid," he declared. She rose with a sigh, tossing her cigarette into the grate. "Ah, there's the difference. A girl must, a man may if he chooses." She surveyed him critically. "Your coat's a little shabby, but who cares? It doesn't keep people from asking you to dine. If I were shabby, no one would have me. A woman is asked out as much for her clothes as for herself. The clothes are the background, the frame, if you like. They don't make success, but they are a part of it. Who wants a dingy woman? We are expected to be pretty and well-dressed till we drop, and if we can't keep it up alone, we have to go into partnership." Selden glanced at her with amusement. It was impossible, even with her lovely eyes imploring him, to take a sentimental view of her case. "Ah, well, there must be plenty of capital on the lookout for such an investment. Perhaps you'll meet your fate tonight at the Trenners'." She returned his look interrogatively. "I thought you might be going there." "Oh, not in that capacity. But there are to be a lot of your set: Gwen Van Osburgh, the Weatheralls, Lady Cressida Wraith, and the George Dorsets." She paused a moment before the last name, and shot a query through her lashes, but he remained imperturbable. "Mrs. Trenner asked me, but I can't get away till the end of the week, and those big parties bore me." "Ah, so they do me," she exclaimed. "Then why go?" "It's part of the business, you forget. And besides, if I didn't, I should be playing bazique with my aunt at Richfield Springs." "That's almost as bad as marrying Dilworth," he agreed, and they both laughed for pure pleasure in their sudden intimacy. She glanced at the clock. "Dear me. I must be off. It's after 5. She paused before the mantelpiece, studying herself in the mirror while she adjusted her veil. The attitude revealed the long slope of her slender sides, which gave a kind of wildwood grace to her outline, as though she were a captured dryad subdued to the conventions of the drawing room, and Selden reflected that it was the same streak of sylvan freedom in her nature that lent such savor to her artificiality. He followed her across the room to the entrance hall, but on the threshold she held out her hand with a gesture of leave-taking. "It's been delightful, and now you'll have to return my visit." "But don't you want me to see you to the station?" "No, goodbye here, please." She let her hand lie in his a moment, smiling up at him adorably. "Goodbye, then, and good luck at Bellomont," he said, opening the door for her. On the landing she paused to look about her. There were 1,000 chances to one against her meeting anybody, but one could never tell, and she always paid for her rare indiscretions by a violent reaction of prudence. There was no one in sight, however, but a charwoman who was scrubbing the stairs. Her own stout person and its surrounding implements took up so much room that Lily, to pass her, had to gather up her skirts and brush against the wall. As she did so, the woman paused in her work and looked up curiously, resting her clenched red fists on the wet cloth she had just drawn from her pail. She had a broad sallow face, slightly pitted with smallpox, and thin straw-colored hair through which her scalp shone unpleasantly. "I beg your pardon," said Lily, intending by her politeness to convey a criticism of the other's manner. The woman, without answering, pushed her pail aside, and continued to stare as Miss Bart swept by with a murmur of silken linings. Lily felt herself flushing under the look. What did the creature suppose? Could one never do the simplest, the most harmless thing, without subjecting oneself to some odious conjecture? Halfway down the next flight, she smiled to think that a charwoman's stare should so perturb her. The poor thing was probably dazzled by such an unwanted apparition. But were such apparitions unwanted on Selden's stairs? Miss Bart was not familiar with the moral code of bachelor's flat houses, and her color rose again as it occurred to her that the woman's persistent gaze implied a groping among past associations. But she put aside the thought with a smile at her own fears, and hastened downward, wondering if she should find a cab short of Fifth Avenue. Under the Georgian porch she paused again, scanning the street for a hansom. None was in sight, but as she reached the sidewalk she ran against a small glossy-looking man with a gardenia in his coat, who raised his hat with a surprised exclamation. "Miss Bart? Well, of all people. This is luck," he declared, and she caught a twinkle of amused curiosity between his screwed-up lids. "Oh, Mr. Rosedale, how are you?" she said, perceiving that the irrepressible annoyance on her face was reflected in the sudden intimacy of his smile. Mr. Rosedale stood scanning her with interest and approval. He was a plump, rosy man of the blonde Jewish type, with smart London clothes fitting him like upholstery, and small sidelong eyes which gave him the air of appraising people as if they were bric-a-brac. He glanced up interrogatively at the porch of the Benedict. "Been up to town for a little shopping, I suppose?" he said, in a tone which had the familiarity of a touch. Miss Bart shrank from it slightly, and then flung herself into precipitate explanations. "Yes, I came up to see my dressmaker. I am just on my way to catch the train to the Trenors."
"Ah, your dressmaker, just so," he said blandly. "I didn't know there were any dressmakers in the Benedict."
"The Benedict?" She looked gently puzzled. "Is that the name of this building?"
"Yes, that's the name. I believe it's an old word for bachelor, isn't it? I happen to own the building, that's the way I know."
His smile deepened as he added with increasing assurance, "But you must let me take you to the station. The Trenors are at Bellamont, of course? You've barely time to catch the 5:40. The dressmaker kept you waiting, I suppose." Lily stiffened under the pleasantry. "Oh, thanks," she stammered, and at that moment her eye caught a hansom drifting down Madison Avenue, and she hailed it with a desperate gesture.
"You're very kind, but I couldn't think of troubling you," she said, extending her hand to Mr. Rosedale, and heedless of his protestations, she sprang into the rescuing vehicle, and called out a breathless order to the driver.
Chapter 2. In the hansom she leaned back with a sigh. Why must a girl pay so dearly for her least escape from routine? Why could one never do a natural thing without having to screen it behind a structure of artifice? She had yielded to a passing impulse in going to Lawrence Selden's rooms, and it was so seldom that she could allow herself the luxury of an impulse. This one, at any rate, was going to cost her rather more than she could afford. She was vexed to see that, in spite of so many years of vigilance, she had blundered twice within 5 minutes. That stupid story about her dressmaker was bad enough. It would have been so simple to tell Rosedale that she had been taking tea with Selden. The mere statement of the fact would have rendered it innocuous. But, after having let herself be surprised in a falsehood, it was doubly stupid to snub the witness of her discomfiture. If she had had the presence of mind to let Rosedale drive her to the station, the concession might have purchased his silence. He had his race's accuracy in the appraisal of values, and to be seen walking down the platform at the crowded afternoon hour in the company of Miss Lily Bart would have been money in his pocket, as he might himself have phrased it. He knew, of course, that there would be a large house party at Bellamont, and the possibility of being taken for one of Mrs. Trenor's guests was doubtless included in his calculations. Mr. Rosedale was still at a stage in his social ascent when it was of importance to produce such impressions. The provoking part was that Lily knew all this, knew how easy it would have been to silence him on the spot, and how difficult it might be to do so afterward. Mr. Simon Rosedale was a man who made it his business to know everything about everyone, whose idea of showing himself to be at home in society was to display an inconvenient familiarity with the habits of those with whom he wished to be thought intimate. Lily was sure that within 24 hours the story of her visiting her dressmaker at the Benedict would be in active circulation among Mr. Rosedale's acquaintances. The worst of it was that she had always snubbed and ignored him.
On his first appearance when her improvident cousin, Jack Stepney, had obtained for him, in return for favors too easily guessed, a card to one of the vast impersonal Van Osburgh crushes Rosedale, with that mixture of artistic sensibility and business astuteness which characterizes his race, had instantly gravitated toward Miss Bart. She understood his motives, for her own course was guided by his nice calculations. Training and experience had taught her to be hospitable to newcomers, since the most unpromising might be useful later on, and there were plenty of available oubliettes to swallow them if they were not. But some intuitive repugnance, getting the better of years of social discipline, had made her push Mr. Rosedale into his oubliette without a trial. He had left behind only the ripple of amusement which his speedy dispatch had caused among her friends, and though later, to shift the metaphor, he reappeared lower down the stream, it was only in fleeting glimpses, with long submergences between. Hitherto Lily had been undisturbed by scruples. In her little set Mr. Rosedale had been pronounced impossible, and Jack Stepney roundly snubbed for his attempt to pay his debts and dinner invitations. Even Mrs. Trenor, whose taste for variety had led her into some hazardous experiments, resisted Jack's attempts to disguise Mr. Rosedale as a novelty, and declared that he was the same little Jew who had been served up and rejected at the social board a dozen times within her memory, and while Judy Trenor was obdurate there was small chance of Mr. Rosedale's penetrating beyond the outer limbo of the Van Osburgh crushes. Jack gave up the contest with a laughing "you'll see," and, sticking manfully to his guns, showed himself with Rosedale at the fashionable restaurants, in company with the personally vivid if socially obscure ladies who are available for such purposes. But the attempt had hitherto been vain, and as Rosedale undoubtedly paid for the dinners, the laugh remained with his debtor. Mr. Rosedale, it will be seen, was thus far not a factor to be feared unless one put oneself in his power. And this was precisely what Miss Bart had done. Her clumsy fib had let him see that she had something to conceal, and she was sure he had a score to settle with her. Something in his smile told her he had not forgotten. She turned from the thought with a little shiver, but it hung on her all the way to the station, and dogged her down the platform with the persistency of Mr. Rosedale himself. She had just time to take her seat before the train started, but having arranged herself in her corner with the instinctive feeling for effect which never forsook her, she glanced about in the hope of seeing some other member of the Trenors' party. She wanted to get away from herself, and conversation was the only means of escape that she knew. Her search was rewarded by the discovery of a very blonde young man with a soft reddish beard, who, at the other end of the carriage, appeared to be dissembling himself behind an unfolded newspaper. Lily's eye brightened, and a faint smile relaxed the drawn lines of her mouth. She had known that Mr. Percy Gryce was to be at Bellemont, but she had not counted on the luck of having him to herself in the train, and the fact banished all perturbing thoughts of Mr. Rosedale. Perhaps, after all, the day was to end more favorably than it had begun. She began to cut the pages of a novel, tranquilly studying her prey through downcast lashes while she organized a method of attack. Something in his attitude of conscious absorption told her that he was aware of her presence. No one had ever been quite so engrossed in an evening paper. She guessed that he was too shy to come up to her, and that she would have to devise some means of approach which should not appear to be an advance on her part. It amused her to think that anyone as rich as Mr. Percy Gryce should be shy, but she was gifted with treasures of indulgence for such idiosyncrasies, and besides, his timidity might serve her purpose better than too much assurance. She had the art of giving self-confidence to the embarrassed, but she was not equally sure of being able to embarrass the self-confident. She waited till the train had emerged from the tunnel and was racing between the ragged edges of the northern suburbs. Then, as it lowered its speed near Yonkers, she rose from her seat and drifted slowly down the carriage. As she passed Mr. Gryce, the train gave a lurch, and he was aware of a slender hand gripping the back of his chair. He rose with a start, his ingenuous face looking as though it had been dipped in crimson, even the reddish tint in his beard seemed to deepen. The train swayed again, almost flinging Miss Bart into his arms. She steadied herself with a laugh and drew back, but he was enveloped in the scent of her dress, and his shoulder had felt her fugitive touch. "Oh, Mr. Gryce, is it you? I'm so sorry, I was trying to find the porter and get some tea." She held out her hand as the train resumed its level rush, and they stood exchanging a few words in the aisle. Yesha was going to Bellemont. He had heard she was to be of the party. He blushed again as he admitted it. And was he to be there for a whole week? How delightful! But at this point one or two belated passengers from the last station forced their way into the carriage, and Lily had to retreat to her seat. "The chair next to mine is empty, do take it," she said over her shoulder, and Mr. Gryce, with considerable embarrassment, succeeded in effecting an exchange which enabled him to transport himself and his bags to her side. "And here is the porter, and perhaps we can have some tea. She signaled to that official, and in a moment, with the ease that seemed to attend the fulfillment of all her wishes, a little table had been set up between the seats, and she had helped Mr. Grice to bestow his encumbering properties beneath it. When the tea came, he watched her in silent fascination while her hands flitted above the tray, looking miraculously fine and slender in contrast to the coarse china and lumpy bread. It seemed wonderful to him that anyone should perform with such careless ease the difficult task of making tea in public in a lurching train. He would never have dared to order it for himself, lest he should attract the notice of his fellow passengers, but, secure in the shelter of her conspicuousness, he sipped the inky draught with a delicious sense of exhilaration. Lily, with the flavor of Selden's caravan tea on her lips, had no great fancy to drown it in the railway brew which seemed such nectar to her companion, but, rightly judging that one of the charms of tea is the fact of drinking it together, she proceeded to give the last touch to Mr. Grice's enjoyment by smiling at him across her lifted cup. "Is it quite right I haven't made it too strong?" she asked solicitously, and he replied with conviction that he had never tasted better tea. "I dare say it is true," she reflected, and her imagination was fired by the thought that Mr. Grice, who might have sounded the depths of the most complex self-indulgence, was perhaps actually taking his first journey alone with a pretty woman. It struck her as providential that she should be the instrument of his initiation. Some girls would not have known how to manage him. They would have overemphasized the novelty of the adventure, trying to make him feel in it the zest of an escapade. But Lily's methods were more delicate. She remembered that her cousin Jack Stepney had once defined Mr. Grice as the young man who had promised his mother never to go out in the rain without his overshoes, and acting on this hint, she resolved to impart a gently domestic air to the scene, in the hope that her companion, instead of feeling that he was doing something reckless or unusual, would merely be led to dwell on the advantage of always having a companion to make one's tea in the train. But in spite of her efforts, conversation flagged after the tray had been removed, and she was driven to take a fresh measurement of Mr. Grice's limitations. It was not, after all, opportunity but imagination that he lacked. He had a mental palate which would never learn to distinguish between railway tea and nectar. There was, however, one topic she could rely on, one spring that she had only to touch to set his simple machinery in motion. She had refrained from touching it because it was a last resource, and she had relied on other arts to stimulate other sensations, but as a settled look of dullness began to creep over his candid features, she saw that extreme measures were necessary. "And how," she said, leaning forward, "are you getting on with your Americana?" His eye became a degree less opaque, it was as though an incipient film had been removed from it, and she felt the pride of a skillful operator. "I've got a few new things," he said, suffused with pleasure, but lowering his voice as though he feared his fellow passengers might be in league to despoil him. She returned a sympathetic inquiry, and gradually he was drawn on to talk of his latest purchases. It was the one subject which enabled him to forget himself, or allowed him, rather, to remember himself without constraint, because he was at home in it, and could assert a superiority that there were few to dispute. Hardly any of his acquaintances cared for Americana, or knew anything about them, and the consciousness of this ignorance threw Mr. Grice's knowledge into agreeable relief. The only difficulty was to introduce the topic and to keep it to the front. Most people showed no desire to have their ignorance dispelled, and Mr. Grice was like a merchant whose warehouses are crammed with an unmarketable commodity. But Miss Bart, it appeared, really did want to know about Americana, and moreover, she was already sufficiently informed to make the task of farther instruction as easy as it was agreeable. She questioned him intelligently, she heard him submissively, and, prepared for the look of lassitude which usually crept over his listeners' faces, he grew eloquent under her receptive gaze. The points she had the presence of mind to glean from Selden, in anticipation of this very contingency, were serving her to such good purpose that she began to think her visit to him had been the luckiest incident of the day. She had once more shown her talent for profiting by the unexpected, and dangerous theories as to the advisability of yielding to impulse were germinating under the surface of smiling attention which she continued to present to her companion. Mr. Grice's sensations, if less definite, were equally agreeable. He felt the confused titillation with which the lower organisms welcome the gratification of their needs, and all his senses floundered in a vague well-being, through which Miss Bart's personality was dimly but pleasantly perceptible. Mr. Grice's interest in Americana had not originated with himself, it was impossible to think of him as evolving any taste of his own. An uncle had left him a collection already noted among bibliophiles. The existence of the collection was the only fact that had ever shed glory on the name of Grice, and the nephew took as much pride in his inheritance as though it had been his own work. Indeed, he gradually came to regard it as such, and to feel a sense of personal complacency when he chanced on any reference to the Gris Americana. Anxious as he was to avoid personal notice, he took, in the printed mention of his name, a pleasure so exquisite and excessive that it seemed a compensation for his shrinking from publicity. To enjoy the sensation as often as possible, he subscribed to all the reviews dealing with book collecting in general, and American history in particular, and as allusions to his library abounded in the pages of these journals, which formed his only reading, he came to regard himself as figuring prominently in the public eye, and to enjoy the thought of the interest which would be excited if the persons he met in the street, or sat among in traveling, were suddenly to be told that he was the possessor of the Gris Americana. Most timidities have such secret compensations, and Miss Bart was discerning enough to know that the inner vanity is generally in proportion to the outer self-depreciation. With a more confident person she would not have dared to dwell so long on one topic, or to show such exaggerated interest in it, but she had rightly guessed that Mr. Grice's egoism was a thirsty soil, requiring constant nurture from without. Miss Bart had the gift of following an undercurrent of thought while she appeared to be sailing on the surface of conversation, and in this case her mental excursion took the form of a rapid survey of Mr. Percy Grice's future as combined with her own. The Grises were from Albany, and but lately introduced to the metropolis, where the mother and son had come, after old Jefferson Grice's death, to take possession of his house in Madison Avenue, an appalling house, all brown stone without and black walnut within, with the Grice library in a fireproof annex that looked like a mausoleum. Lily, however, knew all about them. Young Mr. Grice's arrival had fluttered the maternal breasts of New York, and when a girl has no mother to palpitate for her she must needs be on the alert for herself. Lily, therefore, had not only contrived to put herself in the young man's way, but had made the acquaintance of Mrs. Grice, a monumental woman with the voice of a pulpit orator and a mind preoccupied with the iniquities of her servants, who came sometimes to sit with Mrs. Peniston and learn from that lady how she managed to prevent the kitchen maid smuggling groceries out of the house. Mrs. Grice had a kind of impersonal benevolence, cases of individual need she regarded with suspicion, but she subscribed to institutions when their annual reports showed an impressive surplus. Her domestic duties were manifold, for they extended from furtive inspections of the servants' bedrooms to unannounced descents to the cellar, but she had never allowed herself many pleasures. Once, however, she had had a special edition of the Sarum Rule printed in rubric and presented to every clergyman in the diocese, and the gilt album in which their letters of thanks were pasted formed the chief ornament of her drawing-room table. Percy had been brought up in the principles which so excellent a woman was sure to inculcate. Every form of prudence and suspicion had been grafted on a nature originally reluctant and cautious, with the result that it would have seemed hardly needful for Mrs. Grice to extract his promise about the overshoes, so little likely was he to hazard himself abroad in the rain. After attaining his majority, and coming into the fortune which the late Mr. Grice had made out of a patent device for excluding fresh air from hotels, the young man continued to live with his mother in Albany, but on Jefferson Grice's death, when another large property passed into her son's hands, Mrs. Grice thought that what she called his interests demanded his presence in New York. She accordingly installed herself in the Madison Avenue house, and Percy, whose sense of duty was not inferior to his mother's, spent all his weekdays in the handsome Broad Street office where a batch of pale men on small salaries had grown gray in the management of the Grice estate, and where he was initiated with becoming reverence into every detail of the art of accumulation. As far as Lily could learn, this had hitherto been Mr. Grice's only occupation, and she might have been pardoned for thinking it not too hard a task to interest a young man who had been kept on such low diet. At any rate, she felt herself so completely in command of the situation that she yielded to a sense of security in which all fear of Mr. Rosedale, and of the difficulties on which that fear was contingent, vanished beyond the edge of thought. The stopping of the train at Garrison's would not have distracted her from these thoughts, had she not caught a sudden look of distress in her companion's eye. His seat faced toward the door, and she guessed that he had been perturbed by the approach of an acquaintance, a fact confirmed by the turning of heads and general sense of commotion which her own entrance into a railway carriage was apt to produce. She knew the symptoms at once, and was not surprised to be hailed by the high notes of a pretty woman, who entered the train accompanied by a maid, a bull terrier, and a footman staggering under a load of bags and dressing cases. "Oh, Lily, are you going to Bellomont? Then you can't let me have your seat, I suppose? But I must have a seat in this carriage, porter. You must find me a place at once. Can't someone be put somewhere else? I want to be with my friends. Oh, how do you do, Mr. Grice? Do please make him understand that I must have a seat next to you and Lily." Mrs. George Dorset, regardless of the mild efforts of a traveler with a carpet bag, who was doing his best to make room for her by getting out of the train, stood in the middle of the aisle, diffusing about her the general sense of exasperation which a pretty woman on her travels not infrequently creates. She was smaller and thinner than Lily Bart, with a restless pliability of pose, as if she could have been crumpled up and run through a ring, like the sinuous draperies she affected. Her small pale face seemed the mere setting of a pair of dark exaggerated eyes, of which the visionary gaze contrasted curiously with her self-assertive tone and gestures, so that, as one of her friends observed, she was like a disembodied spirit who took up a great deal of room. Having finally discovered that the seat adjoining Miss Bart's was at her disposal, she possessed herself of it with a farther displacement of her surroundings, explaining meanwhile that she had come across from Mount Kisco in her motor car that morning, and had been kicking her heels for an hour at Garrison's, without even the alleviation of a cigarette, her brute of a husband having neglected to replenish her case before they parted that morning. "And at this hour of the day I don't suppose you've a single one left, have you, Lily?" she plaintively concluded. Miss Bart caught the startled glance of Mr. Percy Gryce, whose own lips were never defiled by tobacco. "What an absurd question, Bertha!" she exclaimed, blushing at the thought of the store she had laid in at Lawrence Selden's. "Why, don't you smoke? Since when have you given it up? What, you never, and you don't either, Mr. Gryce. Ah, of course, how stupid of me, I understand." And Mrs. Dorset leaned back against her traveling cushions with a smile which made Lily wish there had been no vacant seat beside her own. Chapter 3. Bridget Bellomont usually lasted till the small hours, and when Lily went to bed that night she had played too long for her own good. Feeling no desire for the self-communion which awaited her in her room, she lingered on the broad stairway, looking down into the hall below, where the last card players were grouped about the tray of tall glasses and silver-collared decanters which the butler had just placed on a low table near the fire. The hall was arcaded, with a gallery supported on columns of pale yellow marble. Tall clumps of flowering plants were grouped against a background of dark foliage in the angles of the walls. On the crimson carpet a deerhound and two or three spaniels dozed luxuriously before the fire, and the light from the great central lantern overhead shed a brightness on the women's hair and struck sparks from their jewels as they moved. There were moments when such scenes delighted Lily, when they gratified her sense of beauty and her craving for the external finish of life. There were others when they gave a sharper edge to the meagerness of her own opportunities. This was one of the moments when the sense of contrast was uppermost, and she turned away impatiently as Mrs. George Dorset, glittering in serpentine spangles, drew Percy Gryce in her wake to a confidential nook beneath the gallery. It was not that Miss Bart was afraid of losing her newly acquired hold over Mr. Gryce. Mrs. Dorset might startle or dazzle him, but she had neither the skill nor the patience to effect his capture. She was too self-engrossed to penetrate the recesses of his shyness, and besides, why should she care to give herself the trouble? At most it might amuse her to make sport of his simplicity for an evening after that he would be merely a burden to her, and knowing this, she was far too experienced to encourage him. But the mere thought of that other woman, who could take a man up and toss him aside as she willed, without having to regard him as a possible factor in her plans, filled Lily Bart with envy. She had been bored all the afternoon by Percy Gryce. The mere thought seemed to waken an echo of his droning voice, but she could not ignore him on the morrow. She must follow up her success, must submit to more boredom, must be ready with fresh compliances and adaptabilities, and all on the bare chance that he might ultimately decide to do her the honor of boring her for life. It was a hateful fate, but how escape from it? What choice had she? To be herself, or a dirty Farish? As she entered her bedroom, with its softly shaded lights, her lace dressing gown lying across the silken bedspread, her little embroidered slippers before the fire, a vase of carnations filling the air with perfume, and the last novels and magazines lying uncut on a table beside the reading lamp, she had a vision of Miss Farish's cramped flat, with its cheap conveniences and hideous wallpapers. No, she was not made for mean and shabby surroundings, for the squalid compromises of poverty. Her whole being dilated in an atmosphere of luxury. It was the background she required, the only climate she could breathe in. But the luxury of others was not what she wanted. A few years ago it had sufficed her, she had taken her daily meat of pleasure without caring who provided it. Now she was beginning to chafe at the obligations it imposed, to feel herself a mere pensioner on the splendor which had once seemed to belong to her. There were even moments when she was conscious of having to pay her way. For a long time she had refused to play bridge. She knew she could not afford it, and she was afraid of acquiring so expensive a taste. She had seen the danger exemplified in more than one of her associates in young Ned Silverton, for instance, the charming fair boy now seated in abject rapture at the elbow of Mrs. Fisher, a striking divorcee with eyes and gowns as emphatic as the headlines of her case. Lily could remember when young Silverton had stumbled into their circle, with the air of a straight Arcadian who has published charming sonnets in his college journal. Since then he had developed a taste for Mrs. Fisher and Bridge, and the latter at least had involved him in expenses from which he had been more than once rescued by harassed maiden sisters, who treasured the sonnets, and went without sugar in their tea to keep their darling afloat. Ned's case was familiar to Lily. She had seen his charming eyes, which had a good deal more poetry in them than the sonnets, change from surprise to amusement, and from amusement to anxiety, as he passed under the spell of the terrible god of chance, and she was afraid of discovering the same symptoms in her own case. For in the last year she had found that her hostesses expected her to take a place at the card table. It was one of the taxes she had to pay for their prolonged hospitality, and for the dresses and trinkets which occasionally replenished her insufficient wardrobe. And since she had played regularly, the passion had grown on her. Once or twice of late she had won a large sum, and instead of keeping it against future losses, had spent it in dress or jewelry, and the desire to atone for this imprudence, combined with the increasing exhilaration of the game, drove her to risk higher stakes at each fresh venture. She tried to excuse herself on the plea that, in the Trenor set, if one played at all one must either play high or be set down as priggish or stingy, but she knew that the gambling passion was upon her, and that in her present surroundings there was small hope of resisting it. Tonight the luck had been persistently bad, and the little gold purse which hung among her trinkets was almost empty when she returned to her room. She unlocked the wardrobe, and taking out her jewel case, looked under the tray for the roll of bills from which she had replenished the purse before going down to dinner. Only $20 were left. The discovery was so startling that for a moment she fancied she must have been robbed. Then she took paper and pencil, and seating herself at the writing table, tried to reckon up what she had spent during the day. Her head was throbbing with fatigue, and she had to go over the figures again and again, but at last it became clear to her that she had lost $300 at cards. She took out her checkbook to see if her balance was larger than she remembered, but found she had erred in the other direction. Then she returned to her calculations, but figure as she would, she could not conjure back the vanished $300. It was the sum she had set aside to pacify her dressmaker unless she should decide to use it as a sop to the jeweler. At any rate, she had so many uses for it that its very insufficiency had caused her to play high in the hope of doubling it. But of course she had lost she who needed every penny, while Bertha Dorset, whose husband showered money on her, must have pocketed at least 500, and Judy Trenor, who could have afforded to lose 1,000 a night, had left the table clutching such a heap of bills that she had been unable to shake hands with her guests when they bade her good night. A world in which such things could be seemed a miserable place to Lily Bart. But then she had never been able to understand the laws of a universe which was so ready to leave her out of its calculations. She began to undress without ringing for her maid, whom she had sent to bed. She had been long enough in bondage to other people's pleasure to be considerate of those who depended on hers, and in her bitter moods it sometimes struck her that she and her maid were in the same position, except that the latter received her wages more regularly. As she sat before the mirror brushing her hair, her face looked hollow and pale, and she was frightened by two little lines near her mouth. Faint flaws in the smooth curve of the cheek. "Oh, I must stop worrying," she exclaimed. "Unless it's the electric light," she reflected, springing up from her seat and lighting the candles on the dressing table. She turned out the wall lights, and peered at herself between the candle flames. The white oval of her face swam out waveringly from a background of shadows, the uncertain light blurring it like a haze, but the two lines about the mouth remained. Lily rose and undressed in haste. "It is only because I am tired and have such odious things to think about," she kept repeating, and it seemed an added injustice that petty cares should leave a trace on the beauty which was her only defense against them. But the odious things were there, and remained with her. She returned wearily to the thought of Percy Gryce, as a wayfarer picks up a heavy load and toils on after a brief rest. She was almost sure she had landed him, a few days' work and she would win her reward. But the reward itself seemed unpalatable just then, she could get no zest from the thought of victory. It would be a rest from worry, no more and how little that would have seemed to her a few years earlier. Her ambitions had shrunk gradually in the desiccating air of failure. But why had she failed? Was it her own fault or that of destiny? She remembered how her mother, after they had lost their money, used to say to her with a kind of fierce vindictiveness, "But you'll get it all back, you'll get it all back," with your face. The remembrance roused a whole train of association, and she lay in the darkness reconstructing the past out of which her present had grown. A house in which no one ever dined at home unless there was company, a doorbell perpetually ringing, a hall table showered with square envelopes which were opened in haste, and oblong envelopes which were allowed to gather dust in the depths of a bronze jar, a series of French and English maids giving warning amid a chaos of hurriedly ransacked wardrobes and dress closets, an equally changing dynasty of nurses and footmen, quartals in the pantry, the kitchen and the drawing room, precipitate trips to Europe, and returns with gorged trunks and days of interminable unpacking, semi-annual discussions as to where the summer should be spent, gray interludes of economy and brilliant reactions of expense. Such was the setting of Lily Bart's first memories. Ruling the turbulent element called home was the vigorous and determined figure of a mother still young enough to dance her ball dresses to rags, while the hazy outline of a neutral-tinted father filled an intermediate space between the butler and the man who came to wind the clocks. Even to the eyes of infancy, Mrs. Hudson Bart had appeared young, but Lily could not recall the time when her father had not been bald and slightly stooping, with streaks of gray in his hair, and a tired walk. It was a shock to her to learn afterward that he was but 2 years older than her mother. Lily seldom saw her father by daylight. All day he was downtown, and in winter it was long after nightfall when she heard his fagged step on the stairs and his hand on the schoolroom door. He would kiss her in silence, and ask one or two questions of the nurse or the governess, then Mrs. Bart's maid would come to remind him that he was dining out, and he would hurry away with a nod to Lily. In summer, when he joined them for a Sunday at Newport or Southampton, he was even more effaced and silent than in winter. It seemed to tire him to rest, and he would sit for hours staring at the sea line from a quiet corner of the veranda, while the clatter of his wife's existence went on unheeded a few feet off. Generally, however, Mrs. Bart and Lily went to Europe for the summer, and before the steamer was halfway over, Mr. Bart had dipped below the horizon. Sometimes his daughter heard him denounced for having neglected to forward Mrs. Bart's remittances, but for the most part he was never mentioned or thought of till his patient stooping figure presented itself on the New York dock as a buffer between the magnitude of his wife's luggage and the restrictions of the American Custom House. In this desultory yet agitated fashion life went on through Lily's teens, a zigzag broken course down which the family craft glided on a rapid current of amusement, tugged at by the underflow of a perpetual need, the need of more money. Lily could not recall the time when there had been money enough, and in some vague way her father seemed always to blame for the deficiency. It could certainly not be the fault of Mrs. Bart, who was spoken of by her friends as a wonderful manager. Mrs. Bart was famous for the unlimited effect she produced on limited means, and to the lady and her acquaintances there was something heroic in living as though one were much richer than one's bank book denoted. Lily was naturally proud of her mother's aptitude in this line. She had been brought up in the faith that, whatever it cost, one must have a good cook, and be what Mrs. Bart called decently dressed. Mrs. Bart's worst reproach to her husband was to ask him if he expected her to live like a pig, and his replying in the negative was always regarded as a justification for cabling to Paris for an extra dress or two, and telephoning to the jeweler that he might, after all, send home the turquoise bracelet which Mrs. Bart had looked at that morning. Lily knew people who lived like pigs, and their appearance and surroundings justified her mother's repugnance to that form of existence. They were mostly cousins, who inhabited dingy houses with engravings from Cole's Voyage of Life on the drawing-room walls, and slatternly parlor maids who said, "I'll go and see to visitors calling at an hour when all right-minded persons are conventionally if not actually out." The disgusting part of it was that many of these cousins were rich, so that Lily imbibed the idea that if people lived like pigs it was from choice, and through the lack of any proper standard of conduct. This gave her a sense of reflected superiority, and she did not need Mrs. Bart's comments on the family frumps and misers to foster her naturally lively taste for splendor. Lily was 19 when circumstances caused her to revise her view of the universe. The previous year she had made a dazzling debut fringed by a heavy thundercloud of bills. The light of the debut still lingered on the horizon, but the cloud had thickened, and suddenly it broke. The suddenness added to the horror, and there were still times when Lily relived with painful vividness every detail of the day on which the blow fell. She and her mother had been seated at the luncheon table, over the chaufroix and cold salmon of the previous night's dinner. It was one of Mrs. Bart's few economies to consume in private the expensive remnants of her hospitality. Lily was feeling the pleasant languor which is youth's penalty for dancing till dawn, but her mother, in spite of a few lines about the mouth, and under the yellow waves on her temples, was as alert, determined and high in color as if she had risen from an untroubled sleep. In the center of the table, between the melting marron's gloss and candied cherries, a pyramid of American beauties lifted their vigorous stems. They held their heads as high as Mrs. Bart, but their rose color had turned to a dissipated purple, and Lily's sense of fitness was disturbed by their reappearance on the luncheon table. "I really think, Mother," she said reproachfully, "we might afford a few fresh flowers for luncheon. Just some jonquils or lilies of the valley." Mrs. Bart stared. Her own fastidiousness had its eye fixed on the world, and she did not care how the luncheon table looked when there was no one present at it but the family. but she smiled at her daughter's innocence. "Lilies of the valley," she said calmly, "cost $2 a dozen at this season." Lily was not impressed. She knew very little of the value of money. "It would not take more than 6 dozen to fill that bowl," she argued.
"6 dozen what?" asked her father's voice in the doorway.
The two women looked up in surprise. Though it was a Saturday, the sight of Mr. Bard at luncheon was an unwanted one. But neither his wife nor his daughter was sufficiently interested to ask an explanation. Mr. Bard dropped into a chair, and sat gazing absently at the fragment of jellied salmon which the butler had placed before him.
"I was only saying," Lily began, "that I hate to see faded flowers at luncheon, and Mother says a bunch of lilies of the valley would not cost more than $12. Mayn't I tell the florist to send a few every day?"
She leaned confidently toward her father. He seldom refused her anything, and Mrs. Bard had taught her to plead with him when her own entreaties failed. Mr. Bard sat motionless, his gaze still fixed on the salmon, and his lower jaw dropped. He looked even paler than usual, and his thin hair lay in untidy streaks on his forehead. Suddenly he looked at his daughter and laughed. The laugh was so strange that Lily colored under it. She disliked being ridiculed, and her father seemed to see something ridiculous in the request. Perhaps he thought it foolish that she should trouble him about such a trifle.
$12 a day for flowers?
Oh, certainly, my dear, give him an order for 1200. He continued to laugh. Mrs. Bard gave him a quick glance.
You needn't wait, Polwarth, I will ring for you, she said to the butler.
The butler withdrew with an air of silent disapproval, leaving the remains of the chaufferettes on the sideboard.
What is the matter, Hudson? Are you ill? Said Mrs. Bard severely.
She had no tolerance for scenes which were not of her own making, and it was odious to her that her husband should make a show of himself before the servants.
Are you ill? She repeated.
Ill, no, I'm ruined, he said. Lily made a frightened sound, and Mrs. Bard rose to her feet.
Ruined? She cried, but controlling herself instantly, she turned a calm face to Lily.
Shut the pantry door, she said. Lily obeyed, and when she turned back into the room her father was sitting with both elbows on the table, the plate of salmon between them, and his head bowed on his hands. Mrs. Bard stood over him with a white face which made her hair unnaturally yellow. She looked at Lily as the latter approached. Her look was terrible, but her voice was modulated to a ghastly cheerfulness.
Your father is not well, he doesn't know what he is saying. It is nothing, but you had better go upstairs, and don't talk to the servants, she added.
Lily obeyed. She always obeyed when her mother spoke in that voice. She had not been deceived by Mrs. Bard's words. She knew at once that they were ruined. In the dark hours which followed, that awful fact overshadowed even her father's slow and difficult dying. To his wife he no longer counted. He had become extinct when he ceased to fulfill his purpose, and she sat at his side with the provisional air of a traveler who waits for a belated train to start. Lily's feelings were softer. She pitied him in a frightened, ineffectual way. But the fact that he was for the most part unconscious, and that his attention, when she stole into the room, drifted away from her after a moment, made him even more of a stranger than in the nursery days when he had never come home till after dark. She seemed always to have seen him through a blur, first of sleepiness, then of distance and indifference, and now the fog had thickened till he was almost indistinguishable. If she could have performed any little services for him, or have exchanged with him a few of those affecting words which an extensive perusal of fiction had led her to connect with such occasions, the filial instinct might have stirred in her, but her pity, finding no active expression, remained in a state of spectatorship, overshadowed by her mother's grim, unflagging resentment. Every look and act of Mrs. Bart's seemed to say, "You are sorry for him now, but you will feel differently when you see what he has done to us." It was a relief to Lily when her father died. Then a long winter set in. There was a little money left, but to Mrs. Bard it seemed worse than nothing, the mere mockery of what she was entitled to. What was the use of living if one had to live like a pig? She sank into a kind of furious apathy, a state of inert anger against fate. Her faculty for managing deserted her, or she no longer took sufficient pride in it to exert it. It was well enough to manage when by so doing one could keep one's own carriage, but when one's best contrivance did not conceal the fact that one had to go on foot, the effort was no longer worth making. Lily and her mother wandered from place to place, now paying long visits to relations whose housekeeping Mrs. Bard criticized, and who deplored the fact that she let Lily breakfast in bed when the girl had no prospects before her, and now vegetating in cheap continental refuges, where Mrs. Bard held herself fiercely aloof from the frugal tea tables of her companions in misfortune. She was especially careful to avoid her old friends in the scenes of her former successes. To be poor seemed to her such a confession of failure that it amounted to disgrace, and she detected a note of condescension in the friendliest advances. Only one thought consoled her, and that was the contemplation of Lily's beauty. She studied it with a kind of passion, as though it were some weapon she had slowly fashioned for her vengeance. It was the last asset in their fortunes, the nucleus around which their life was to be rebuilt. She watched it jealously, as though it were her own property and Lily its mere custodian, and she tried to instill into the latter a sense of the responsibility that such a charge involved. She followed in imagination the career of other beauties, pointing out to her daughter what might be achieved through such a gift, and dwelling on the awful warning of those who, in spite of it, had failed to get what they wanted. To Mrs. Bart, only stupidity could explain the lamentable denouement of some of her examples. She was not above the inconsistency of charging fate, rather than herself, with her own misfortunes, but she inveighed so acrimoniously against love matches that Lily would have fancied her own marriage had been of that nature, had not Mrs. Bart frequently assured her that she had been talked into it by whom, she never made clear. Lily was duly impressed by the magnitude of her opportunities. The dinginess of her present life threw into enchanting relief the existence to which she felt herself entitled. To a less illuminated intelligence, Mrs. Bart's counsels might have been dangerous, but Lily understood that beauty is only the raw material of conquest, and that to convert it into success other arts are required. She knew that to betray any sense of superiority was a subtler form of the stupidity her mother denounced, and it did not take her long to learn that a beauty needs more tact than the possessor of an average set of features. Her ambitions were not as crude as Mrs. Bart's. It had been among that lady's grievances that her husband in the early days, before he was too tired, had wasted his evenings in what she vaguely described as reading poetry, and among the effects packed off to auction after his death were a score or two of dingy volumes which had struggled for existence among the boots and medicine bottles of his dressing room shelves. There was in Lily a vein of sentiment, perhaps transmitted from this source, which gave an idealizing touch to her most prosaic purposes. She liked to think of her beauty as a power for good, as giving her the opportunity to attain a position where she should make her influence felt in the vague diffusion of refinement and good taste. She was fond of pictures and flowers, and of sentimental fiction, and she could not help thinking that the possession of such tastes ennobled her desire for worldly advantages. She would not indeed have cared to marry a man who was merely rich. She was secretly ashamed of her mother's crude passion for money. Lily's preference would have been for an English nobleman with political ambitions and vast estates, or, for second choice, an Italian prince with a castle in the Apennines and an hereditary office in the Vatican. Lost causes had a romantic charm for her, and she liked to picture herself as standing aloof from the vulgar press of the Quirinal, and sacrificing her pleasure to the claims of an immemorial tradition. How long ago and how far off it all seemed! Those ambitions were hardly more futile and childish than the earlier ones which had centered about the possession of a French-jointed doll with real hair. Was it only 10 years since she had wavered in imagination between the English earl and the Italian prince? Relentlessly her mind traveled on over the dreary interval. After 2 years of hungry roaming, Mrs. Bart had died of a deep disgust. She had hated dinginess, and it was her fate to be dingy. Her visions of a brilliant marriage for Lily had faded after the first year. People can't marry you if they don't see you, and how can they see you in these holes where we're stuck? That was the burden of her lament, and her last adjuration to her daughter was to escape from dinginess if she could. Don't let it creep up on you and drag you down. Fight your way out of it somehow, you're young and can do it, she insisted. She had died during one of their brief visits to New York, and there Lily at once became the center of a family council composed of the wealthy relatives whom she had been taught to despise for living like pigs. It may be that they had an inkling of the sentiments in which she had been brought up, for none of them manifested a very lively desire for her company. Indeed, the question threatened to remain unsolved till Mrs. Peniston with a sigh announced, "I'll try her for a year." Everyone was surprised, but one and all concealed their surprise, lest Mrs. Peniston should be alarmed by it into reconsidering her decision. Mrs. Peniston was Mr. Bart's widowed sister, and if she was by no means the richest of the family group, its other members nevertheless abounded in reasons why she was clearly destined by Providence to assume the charge of Lily. In the first place, she was alone, and it would be charming for her to have a young companion. Then she sometimes traveled, and Lily's familiarity with foreign customs, deplored as a misfortune by her more conservative relatives, would at least enable her to act as a kind of courier. But as a matter of fact, Mrs. Peniston had not been affected by these considerations. She had taken the girl simply because no one else would have her, and because she had the kind of moral mauvaise honte which makes the public display of selfishness difficult, though it does not interfere with its private indulgence. It would have been impossible for Mrs. Peniston to be heroic on a desert island, but with the eyes of her little world upon her, she took a certain pleasure in her act. She reaped the reward to which disinterestedness is entitled, and found an agreeable companion in her niece. She had expected to find Lily headstrong, critical and foreign, for even Mrs. Peniston, though she occasionally went abroad, had the family dread of foreignness, but the girl showed a pliancy, which, to a more penetrating mind than her aunt's, might have been less reassuring than the open selfishness of youth. Misfortune had made Lily supple instead of hardening her, and a pliable substance is less easy to break than a stiff one. Mrs. Peniston, however, did not suffer from her niece's adaptability. Lily had no intention of taking advantage of her aunt's good nature. She was in truth grateful for the refuge offered her. Mrs. Peniston's opulent interior was at least not externally dingy. But dinginess is a quality which assumes all manner of disguises, and Lily soon found that it was as latent in the expensive routine of her aunt's life as in the makeshift existence of a continental pension. Mrs. Peniston was one of the episodical persons who form the padding of life. It was impossible to believe that she had herself ever been a focus of activities. The most vivid thing about her was the fact that her grandmother had been a Van Alston. This connection with the well-fed and industrious stock of early New York revealed itself in the glacial neatness of Mrs. Peniston's drawing room and in the excellence of her cuisine. She belonged to the class of old New Yorkers who have always lived well, dressed expensively, and done little else, and to these inherited obligations Mrs. Peniston faithfully conformed. She had always been a looker on at life, and her mind resembled one of those little mirrors which her Dutch ancestors were accustomed to affix to their upper windows, so that from the depths of an impenetrable domesticity they might see what was happening in the street. Mrs. Peniston was the owner of a country place in New Jersey, but she had never lived there since her husband's death, a remote event, which appeared to dwell in her memory chiefly as a dividing point in the personal reminiscences that formed the staple of her conversation. She was a woman who remembered dates with intensity, and could tell at a moment's notice whether the drawing-room curtains had been renewed before or after Mr. Peniston's last illness. Mrs. Peniston thought the country lonely and trees damp, and cherished a vague fear of meeting people. To guard against such contingencies she frequented the more populous watering-places, where she installed herself impersonally in a hired house and looked on at life through the matting screen of her veranda. In the care of such a guardian, it soon became clear to Lily that she was to enjoy only the material advantages of good food and expensive clothing, and, though far from underrating these, she would gladly have exchanged them for what Mrs. Bart had taught her to regard as opportunities. She sighed to think what her mother's fierce energies would have accomplished, had they been coupled with Mrs. Peniston's resources. Lily had abundant energy of her own, but it was restricted by the necessity of adapting herself to her aunt's habits. She saw that at all costs she must keep Mrs. Peniston's favorite ill, as Mrs. Bart would have phrased it, she could stand on her own legs. Lily had no mind for the vagabond life of the poor relation, and to adapt herself to Mrs. Peniston she had, to some degree, to assume that lady's passive attitude. She had fancied at first that it would be easy to draw her aunt into the whirl of her own activities, but there was a static force in Mrs. Peniston against which her niece's efforts spent themselves in vain. To attempt to bring her into active relation with life was like tugging at a piece of furniture which has been screwed to the floor. She did not, indeed, expect Lily to remain equally immovable. She had all the American guardian's indulgence for the volatility of youth. She had indulgence also for certain other habits of her niece's. It seemed to her natural that Lily should spend all her money on dress, and she supplemented the girl's scanty income by occasional handsome presents meant to be applied to the same purpose. Lily, who was intensely practical, would have preferred a fixed allowance, but Mrs. Peniston liked the periodical recurrence of gratitude evoked by unexpected checks, and was perhaps shrewd enough to perceive that such a method of giving kept alive in her niece a salutary sense of dependence. Beyond this, Mrs. Peniston had not felt called upon to do anything for her charge. She had simply stood aside and let her take the field. Lily had taken it, at first with the confidence of assured possessorship, then with gradually narrowing demands, till now she found herself actually struggling for a foothold on the broad space which had once seemed her own for the asking. How it happened she did not yet know. Sometimes she thought it was because Mrs. Peniston had been too passive, and again she feared it was because she herself had not been passive enough. Had she shown an undue eagerness for victory? Had she lacked patience, pliancy and dissimulation? Whether she charged herself with these faults or absolved herself from them, made no difference in the sum total of her failure. Younger and plainer girls had been married off by dozens, and she was 29, and still Miss Bart. She was beginning to have fits of angry rebellion against fate, when she longed to drop out of the race and make an independent life for herself. But what manner of life would it be? She had barely enough money to pay her dressmaker's bills and her gambling debts, and none of the desultory interests which she dignified with the name of tastes was pronounced enough to enable her to live contentedly in obscurity. Ah, no, she was too intelligent not to be honest with herself. She knew that she hated dinginess as much as her mother had hated it, and to her last breath she meant to fight against it, dragging herself up again and again above its flood till she gained the bright pinnacles of success which presented such a slippery surface to her clutch. Chapter 4. The next morning, on her breakfast tray, Miss Bart found a note from her hostess. "Dearest Lily," it ran, "if it is not too much of a bore to be down by 10, will you come to my sitting room to help me with some tiresome things?" Lily tossed aside the note and subsided on her pillows with a sigh. It was a bore to be down by 10, an hour regarded at Bellamont as vaguely synchronous with sunrise, and she knew too well the nature of the tiresome things in question. Miss Prague, the secretary, had been called away, and there would be notes and dinner cards to write, lost addresses to hunt up, and other social drudgery to perform. It was understood that Miss Bart should fill the gap in such emergencies, and she usually recognized the obligation without a murmur. Today, however, it renewed the sense of servitude which the previous night's review of her checkbook had produced. Everything in her surroundings ministered to feelings of ease and amenity. The windows stood open to the sparkling freshness of the September morning, and between the yellow boughs she caught a perspective of hedges and parterres leading by degrees of lessening formality to the free undulations of the park. Her maid had kindled a little fire on the hearth, and it contended cheerfully with the sunlight which slanted across the moss-green carpet and caressed the curved sides of an old marquetry desk. Near the bed stood a table holding her breakfast tray, with its harmonious porcelain and silver, a handful of violets and a slender glass, and the morning paper folded beneath her letters. There was nothing new to Lily in these tokens of a studied luxury, but, though they formed a part of her atmosphere, she never lost her sensitiveness to their charm. Mere display left her with a sense of superior distinction, but she felt an affinity to all the subtler manifestations of wealth. Mrs. Trenor's summons, however, suddenly recalled her state of dependence, and she rose and dressed in a mood of irritability that she was usually too prudent to indulge. She knew that such emotions leave lines on the face as well as in the character, and she had meant to take warning by the little creases which her midnight survey had revealed. The matter-of-course tone of Mrs. Trenor's greeting deepened her irritation. If one did drag oneself out of bed at such an hour, and come down fresh and radiant to the monotony of note-writing, some special recognition of the sacrifice seemed fitting. But Mrs. Trenor's tone showed no consciousness of the fact. "Oh, Lily, that's nice of you," she merely sighed across the chaos of letters, bills and other domestic documents which gave an incongruously commercial touch to the slender elegance of her writing table. "There are such lots of horrors this morning," she added, clearing a space in the center of the confusion and rising to yield her seat to Miss Bart. Mrs. Trenor was a tall, fair woman, whose height just saved her from redundancy. Her rosy blondness had survived some 40 years of futile activity without showing much trace of ill usage except in a diminished play of feature. It was difficult to define her beyond saying that she seemed to exist only as a hostess, not so much from any exaggerated instinct of hospitality as because she could not sustain life except in a crowd. The collective nature of her interests exempted her from the ordinary rivalries of her sex, and she knew no more personal emotion than that of hatred for the woman who presumed to give bigger dinners or have more amusing house parties than herself. As her social talents, backed by Mr. Trenor's bank account, almost always assured her ultimate triumph in such competitions, success had developed in her an unscrupulous good nature toward the rest of her sex, and in Miss Bart's utilitarian classification of her friends, Mrs. Trenor ranked as the woman who was least likely to go back on her. It was simply inhuman of Prague to go off now, Mrs. Trenor declared, as her friend seated herself at the desk. "She says her sister is going to have a baby as if that were anything to having a house party. I'm sure I shall get most horribly mixed up and there will be some awful rows. When I was down at Tuxedo I asked a lot of people for next week, and I've mislaid the list and can't remember who is coming. And this week is going to be a horrid failure too, and Gwen Van Osburg will go back and tell her mother how bored people were. I did mean to ask the Weatheralls, that was a blunder of Gus's. They disapprove of Carrie Fisher, you know. As if one could help having Carrie Fisher. It was foolish of her to get that second divorce. Carrie always overdoes things, but she said the only way to get a penny out of Fisher was to divorce him and make him pay alimony. And poor Carrie has to consider every dollar. It's really absurd of Alice Weatherall to make such a fuss about meeting her, when one thinks of what society is coming to. Someone said the other day that there was a divorce and a case of appendicitis in every family one knows. Besides, Carrie is the only person who can keep Gus in a good humor when we have bores in the house. Have you noticed that all the husbands like her? All, I mean, except her own. It's rather clever of her to have made a specialty of devoting herself to dull people. The field is such a large one, and she has it practically to herself. She finds compensations. No doubt I know she borrows money of Gus, but then I'd pay her to keep him in a good humor, so I can't complain, after all. Mrs. Trenor paused to enjoy the spectacle of Miss Bart's efforts to unravel her tangled correspondence. But it is only the Weatheralls and Carrie, she resumed, with a fresh note of lament. The truth is, I'm awfully disappointed in Lady Cressida Wraith.
Disappointed? Had you known her before?
Mercy, no, never saw her till yesterday. Lady Skiddaw sent her over with letters to the Van Osburghs, and I heard that Maria Van Osburgh was asking a big party to meet her this week, so I thought it would be fun to get her away, and Jack Stepney, who knew her in India, managed it for me. Maria was furious, and actually had the impudence to make Gwen invite herself here, so that they shouldn't be quite out of it. If I'd known what Lady Cressida was like, they could have had her in welcome. But I thought any friend of the Skiddaws was sure to be amusing. You remember what fun Lady Skiddaw was? There were times when I simply had to send the girls out of the room. Besides, Lady Cressida is the Duchess of Beltshire's sister, and I naturally supposed she was the same sort, but you never can tell in those English families. They are so big that there's room for all kinds, and it turns out that Lady Cressida is the moral one, married a clergyman and does missionary work in the East End. Think of my taking such a lot of trouble about a clergyman's wife, who wears Indian jewelry and botanizes. She made Gus take her all through the glasshouses yesterday, and bothered him to death by asking him the names of the plants. Fancy treating Gus as if he were the gardener. Mrs. Trenor brought this out in a crescendo of indignation.
Oh, well, perhaps Lady Cressida will reconcile the Weatheralls to meeting Carrie Fisher, said Miss Bart pacifically.
I'm sure I hope so. But she is boring all the men horribly, and if she takes to distributing tracts, as I hear she does, it will be too depressing. The worst of it is that she would have been so useful at the right time. You know, we have to have the bishop once a year, and she would have given just the right tone to things. I always have horrid luck about the bishop's visits, added Mrs. Trenor, whose present misery was being fed by a rapidly rising tide of reminiscence. Last year, when he came, Gus forgot all about his being here, and brought home the Ned Wintons and the Farleys, 5 divorces and 6 sets of children between them.
When is Lady Cressida going? Lily inquired.
Mrs. Trenor cast up her eyes in despair. My dear, if one only knew. I was in such a hurry to get her away from Maria that I actually forgot to name a date, and Gus says she told someone she meant to stop here all winter.
To stop here? In this house?
Don't be silly, in America. But if no one else asks her, you know they never go to hotels.
Perhaps Gus only said it to frighten you.
No, I heard her tell Bertha Dorset that she had 6 months to put in while her husband was taking the cure in the Engadina. You should have seen Bertha look vacant. But it's no joke. You know, if she stays here all the autumn she'll spoil everything, and Maria Van Osburgh will simply exult. At this affecting vision Mrs. Trenor's voice trembled with self-pity.
Oh, Judy, as if anyone were ever bored at Bellomont.
Miss Bart tactfully protested. You know perfectly well that, if Mrs. Van Osburgh were to get all the right people and leave you with all the wrong ones, you'd manage to make things go off, and she wouldn't. Such an assurance would usually have restored Mrs. Trenor's complacency, but on this occasion it did not chase the cloud from her brow.
It isn't only Lady Cressida, she lamented. Everything has gone wrong this week. I can see that Bertha Dorset is furious with me.
Furious with you? Why?
Because I told her that Lawrence Selden was coming, but he wouldn't, after all, and she's quite unreasonable enough to think it's my fault.
Miss Bart put down her pen and sat absently gazing at the note she had begun.
I thought that was all over, she said.
So it is, on his side. And of course Bertha has been idle since. But I fancy she's out of a job just at present, and someone gave me a hint that I had better ask Lawrence. Well, I did ask him, but I couldn't make him come, and now I suppose she'll take it out of me by being perfectly nasty to everyone else.
Oh, she may take it out of him by being perfectly charming to someone else.
Mrs. Trenor shook her head dolefully. She knows he wouldn't mind. And who else is there? Alice Weatherall won't let Lucius out of her sight. Ned Silverton can't take his eyes off Carrie Fisher, poor boy. Gus is bored by Bertha. Jack Stepney knows her too well, and well, to be sure, there's Percy Grice. She sat up smiling at the thought.
Miss Bart's countenance did not reflect the smile.
Oh, she and Mr. Grice would not be likely to hit it off.
You mean that she'd shock him and he'd bore her?
Well, that's not such a bad beginning, you know. But I hope she won't take it into her head to be nice to him, for I asked him here on purpose for you. Lily laughed. Merci du compliment. I should certainly have no show against Bertha. Do you think I am uncomplimentary? I'm not really, you know. Everyone knows you're 1,000 times handsomer and cleverer than Bertha, but then you're not nasty. And for always getting what she wants in the long run, commend me to a nasty woman. Miss Bart stared in affected reproval. I thought you were so fond of Bertha. Oh, I am. It's much safer to be fond of dangerous people. But she is dangerous, and if I ever saw her up to mischief, it's now. I can tell by poor George's manner. That man is a perfect barometer. He always knows when Bertha is going to fall? Miss Bart suggested. Don't be shocking. You know he believes in her still. And of course I don't say there's any real harm in Bertha. Only she delights in making people miserable, and especially poor George. Well, he seems cut out for the part. I don't wonder she likes more cheerful companionship. Oh, George is not as dismal as you think. If Bertha did worry him, he would be quite different. Or if she'd leave him alone, and let him arrange his life as he pleases. But she doesn't dare lose her hold of him on account of the money, and so when he isn't jealous she pretends to be. Miss Bart went on writing in silence, and her hostess sat following her train of thought with frowning intensity. Do you know, she exclaimed after a long pause, I believe I'll call up Lawrence on the telephone and tell him he simply must come? Oh, don't, said Lily, with a quick suffusion of color. The blush surprised her almost as much as it did her hostess, who, though not commonly observant of facial changes, sat staring at her with puzzled eyes. Good gracious, Lily, how handsome you are! Why? Do you dislike him so much? Not at all, I like him. But if you are actuated by the benevolent intention of protecting me from Bertha, I don't think I need your protection. Mrs. Trenor sat up with an exclamation. Lily! Percy? Do you mean to say you've actually done it? Miss Bart smiled. I only mean to say that Mr. Gryce and I are getting to be very good friends. HMIC. Mrs. Trenor fixed a rapt eye upon her. You know they say he has $800,000 a year and spends nothing, except on some rubbishy old books. And his mother has heart disease and will leave him a lot more. Oh, Lily, do go slowly, her friend adjured her. Miss Bart continued to smile without annoyance. I shouldn't, for instance, she remarked, be in any haste to tell him that he had a lot of rubbishy old books. No, of course not, I know you're wonderful about getting up people's subjects. But he's horribly shy, and easily shocked, and. Why don't you say it, Judy? I have the reputation of being on the hunt for a rich husband? Oh, I don't mean that, he wouldn't believe it of you at first, said Mrs. Trenor, with candid shrewdness. But you know things are rather lively here at times. I must give Jack and Gus a hint, and if he thought you were what his mother would call fast, oh, well, you know what I mean. Don't wear your scarlet crepe to chine for dinner, and don't smoke if you can help it, Lily dear. Lily pushed aside her finished work with a dry smile. You're very kind, Judy, I'll lock up my cigarettes and wear that last year's dress you sent me this morning. And if you are really interested in my career, perhaps you'll be kind enough not to ask me to play bridge again this evening. Bridge? Does he mind bridge, too? Oh, Lily, what an awful life you'll lead. But of course I won't. Why didn't you give me a hint last night? There's nothing I wouldn't do, you poor duck, to see you happy. And Mrs. Trenor, glowing with her sex's eagerness to smooth the course of true love, enveloped Lily in a long embrace. You're quite sure, she added solicitously, as the latter extricated herself, that you wouldn't like me to telephone for Lawrence Selden? Quite sure, said Lily. The next 3 days demonstrated to her own complete satisfaction Miss Bart's ability to manage her affairs without extraneous aid. As she sat, on the Saturday afternoon, on the terrace at Bellamont, she smiled at Mrs. Trenor's fear that she might go too fast. If such a warning had ever been needful, the years had taught her a salutary lesson, and she flattered herself that she now knew how to adapt her pace to the object of pursuit. In the case of Mr. Gryce, she had found it well to flutter ahead, losing herself elusively and luring him on from depth to depth of unconscious intimacy. The surrounding atmosphere was propitious to this scheme of courtship. Mrs. Trenor, true to her word, had shown no signs of expecting Lily at the bridge table, and had even hinted to the other card players that they were to betray no surprise at her unwonted defection. In consequence of this hint, Lily found herself the center of that feminine solicitude which envelops a young woman in the mating season. A solitude was tacitly created for her in the crowded existence of Bellamont, and her friends could not have shown a greater readiness for self-effacement had her wooing been adorned with all the attributes of romance. In Lily's set, this conduct implied a sympathetic comprehension of her motives, and Mr. Grice rose in her esteem as she saw the consideration he inspired. The terrace at Bellamont on a September afternoon was a spot propitious to sentimental musings, and as Miss Bart stood leaning against the balustrade above the sunken garden, at a little distance from the animated group about the tea table, she might have been lost in the mazes of an inarticulate happiness. In reality, her thoughts were finding definite utterance in the tranquil recapitulation of the blessings in store for her. From where she stood, she could see them embodied in the form of Mr. Grice, who, in a light overcoat and muffler, sat somewhat nervously on the edge of his chair, while Carrie Fisher, with all the energy of eye and gesture with which nature and art had combined to endow her, pressed on him the duty of taking part in the task of municipal reform. Mrs. Fisher's latest hobby was municipal reform. It had been preceded by an equal zeal for socialism, which had in turn replaced an energetic advocacy of Christian Science. Mrs. Fisher was small, fiery and dramatic, and her hands and eyes were admirable instruments in the service of whatever causes she happened to espouse. She had, however, the fault common to enthusiasts of ignoring any slackness of response on the part of her hearers, and Lily was amused by her unconsciousness of the resistance displayed in every angle of Mr. Grice's attitude. Lily herself knew that his mind was divided between the dread of catching cold if he remained out of doors too long at that hour, and the fear that, if he retreated to the house, Mrs. Fisher might follow him up with a paper to be signed. Mr. Grice had a constitutional dislike to what he called committing himself, and tenderly as he cherished his health, he evidently concluded that it was safer to stay out of reach of pen and ink till chance released him from Mrs. Fisher's toils. Meanwhile, he cast agonized glances in the direction of Miss Bart, whose only response was to sink into an attitude of more graceful abstraction. She had learned the value of contrast in throwing her charms into relief, and was fully aware of the extent to which Mrs. Fisher's volubility was enhancing her own repose. She was roused from her musings by the approach of her cousin Jack Stepney, who, at Gwen Van Osburgh's side, was returning across the garden from the tennis court. The couple in question were engaged in the same kind of romance in which Lily figured, and the latter felt a certain annoyance in contemplating what seemed to her a caricature of her own situation. Miss Van Osburgh was a large girl with flat surfaces and no highlights. Jack Stepney had once said of her that she was as reliable as roast mutton. His own taste was in the line of less solid and more highly seasoned diet, but hunger makes any fare palatable, and there had been times when Mr. Stepney had been reduced to a crust. Lily considered with interest the expression of their faces. The girls turned toward her companions like an empty plate held up to be filled, while the man lounging at her side already betrayed the encroaching boredom which would presently crack the thin veneer of his smile. "How impatient men are," Lily reflected. "All Jack has to do to get everything he wants is to keep quiet and let that girl marry him, whereas I have to calculate and contrive, and retreat and advance, as if I were going through an intricate dance, where one misstep would throw me hopelessly out of time." As they drew nearer, she was whimsically struck by a kind of family likeness between Miss Van Osburgh and Percy Grice. There was no resemblance of feature. Grice was handsome in a didactic way. He looked like a clever pupil's drawing from a plaster cast, while Gwen's countenance had no more modeling than a face painted on a toy balloon. But the deeper affinity was unmistakable. The two had the same prejudices and ideals, and the same quality of making other standards non-existent by ignoring them. This attribute was common to most of Lily's set. They had a force of negation which eliminated everything beyond their own range of perception. Grice and Miss Van Osburgh were, in short, made for each other by every law of moral and physical correspondence, yet they wouldn't look at each other, Lily mused. They never do. Each of them wants a creature of a different race, of Jack's race and mine, with all sorts of intuitions, sensations and perceptions that they don't even guess the existence of. And they always get what they want. She stood talking with her cousin and Miss Van Osburgh, till a slight cloud on the latter's brow advised her that even cousinly amenities were subject to suspicion, and Miss Bart, mindful of the necessity of not exciting enmities at this crucial point of her career, dropped aside while the happy couple proceeded toward the tea table. Seating herself on the upper step of the terrace, Lily leaned her head against the honeysuckles wreathing the balustrade. The fragrance of the late blossoms seemed an emanation of the tranquil scene, a landscape tutored to the last degree of rural elegance. In the foreground glowed the warm tints of the gardens. Beyond the lawn, with its pyramidal pale gold maples and velvety firs, sloped pastures dotted with cattle, and through a long glade the river widened like a lake under the silver light of September. Lily did not want to join the circle about the tea table. They represented the future she had chosen, and she was content with it, but in no haste to anticipate its joys. The certainty that she could marry Percy Grice when she pleased had lifted a heavy load from her mind, and her money troubles were too recent for their removal not to leave a sense of relief which a less discerning intelligence might have taken for happiness. Her vulgar cares were at an end. She would be able to arrange her life as she pleased, to soar into the empyrean of security where creditors cannot penetrate. She would have smarter gowns than Judy Trenor, and far, far more jewels than Bertha Dorset. She would be free forever from the shifts, the expedients, the humiliations of the relatively poor. Instead of having to flatter, she would be flattered. Instead of being grateful, she would receive thanks. There were old scores she could pay off as well as old benefits she could return. And she had no doubts as to the extent of her power. She knew that Mr. Gryce was of the small cherry type most inaccessible to impulses and emotions. He had the kind of character in which prudence is a vice, and good advice the most dangerous nourishment. But Lily had known the species before. She was aware that such a guarded nature must find one huge outlet of egoism, and she determined to be to him what his Americana had hitherto been, the one possession in which he took sufficient pride to spend money on it. She knew that this generosity to self is one of the forms of meanness, and she resolved so to identify herself with her husband's vanity that to gratify her wishes would be to him the most exquisite form of self-indulgence. The system might at first necessitate a resort to some of the very shifts and expedients from which she intended it should free her. But she felt sure that in a short time she would be able to play the game in her own way. How should she have distrusted her powers? Her beauty itself was not the mere ephemeral possession it might have been in the hands of inexperience. Her skill in enhancing it, the care she took of it, the use she made of it, seemed to give it a kind of permanence. She felt she could trust it to carry her through to the end. And the end, on the whole, was worthwhile. Life was not the mockery she had thought it 3 days ago. There was room for her, after all, in this crowded selfish world of pleasure whence, so short a time since, her poverty had seemed to exclude her. These people whom she had ridiculed and yet envied were glad to make a place for her in the charmed circle about which all her desires revolved. They were not as brutal and self-engrossed as she had fancied, or rather, since it would no longer be necessary to flatter and humor them, that side of their nature became less conspicuous. Society is a revolving body which is apt to be judged according to its place in each man's heaven, and at present it was turning its illuminated face to Lily. In the rosy glow it diffused, her companion seemed full of amiable qualities. She liked their elegance, their lightness, their lack of emphasis, even the self-assurance which at times was so like obtuseness now seemed the natural sign of social ascendancy. They were lords of the only world she cared for, and they were ready to admit her to their ranks and let her lord it with them. Already she felt within her a stealing allegiance to their standards, an acceptance of their limitations, a disbelief in the things they did not believe in, a contemptuous pity for the people who were not able to live as they lived. The early sunset was slanting across the park. Through the boughs of the long avenue beyond the gardens she caught the flash of wheels, and divined that more visitors were approaching. There was a movement behind her, a scattering of steps and voices. It was evident that the party about the tea table was breaking up. Presently she heard a tread behind her on the terrace. She supposed that Mr. Gryce had at last found means to escape from his predicament, and she smiled at the significance of his coming to join her instead of beating an instant retreat to the fireside. She turned to give him the welcome which such gallantry deserved, but her greeting wavered into a blush of wonder, for the man who had approached her was Lawrence Selden. "You see, I came after all," he said, but before she had time to answer, Mrs. Dorset, breaking away from a lifeless colloquy with her host, had stepped between them with a little gesture of appropriation. Chapter 5. The observance of Sunday at Bellomont was chiefly marked by the punctual appearance of the smart omnibus destined to convey the household to the little church at the gates. Whether anyone got into the omnibus or not was a matter of secondary importance, since by standing there it not only bore witness to the orthodox intentions of the family, but made Mrs. Trenor feel, when she finally heard it drive away, that she had somehow vicariously made use of it. It was Mrs. Trenor's theory that her daughters actually did go to church every Sunday, but their French governess's convictions calling her to the rival fane, and the fatigues of the week keeping their mother in her room till luncheon, there was seldom anyone present to verify the fact. Now and then, in a spasmodic burst of virtue when the house had been too uproarious overnight, Gus Trenor forced his genial bulk into a tight frock coat and routed his daughters from their slumbers, but habitually, as Lily explained to Mr. Gryce, this parental duty was forgotten till the church bells were ringing across the park, and the omnibus had driven away empty. Lily had hinted to Mr. Gryce that this neglect of religious observances was repugnant to her early traditions, and that during her visits to Bellomont she regularly accompanied Muriel and Hilda to church. This tallied with the assurance, also confidentially imparted, that, never having played bridge before, she had been dragged into it on the night of her arrival, and had lost an appalling amount of money in consequence of her ignorance of the game and of the rules of betting. Mr. Grice was undoubtedly enjoying Bellomont. He liked the ease and glitter of the life, and the luster conferred on him by being a member of this group of rich and conspicuous people. But he thought it a very materialistic society. There were times when he was frightened by the talk of the men and the looks of the ladies, and he was glad to find that Miss Bart, for all her ease and self-possession, was not at home in so ambiguous an atmosphere. For this reason he had been especially pleased to learn that she would, as usual, attend the young Trenors to church on Sunday morning, and as he paced the gravel sweep before the door, his light overcoat on his arm and his prayer book in one carefully gloved hand, he reflected agreeably on the strength of character which kept her true to her early training in surroundings so subversive to religious principles. For a long time Mr. Grice and the omnibus had the gravel sweep to themselves, but, far from regretting this deplorable indifference on the part of the other guests, he found himself nourishing the hope that Miss Bart might be unaccompanied. The precious minutes were flying, however, the big chestnuts pawed the ground and flecked their impatient sides with foam, the coachman seemed to be slowly petrifying on the box, and the groom on the doorstep, and still the lady did not come. Suddenly, however, there was a sound of voices and a rustle of skirts in the doorway, and Mr. Grice, restoring his watch to his pocket, turned with a nervous start.